to put it very bluntly, told what to do. The Socratic view. So, if we put all of these criticisms together, I think you'll find the heart and soul of the Socratic critique of democracy. It's one of the most famous, in fact, I would think the most famous criticisms of democracy that can be found in the history of Western political philosophy. And it has gotten many, many people angry. But now let me say something that, in fact, is very surprising. And I don't think most readers or scholars pay nearly enough attention to it in their understanding of the Republic. Socrates, despite these severe criticisms of democracy that he makes, is actually ambivalent when it comes to democracy. Let me give you two quotes. The first is from 557c. He says, "It is probably the fairest, the most beautiful of all regimes." Even more surprisingly, he says the following at 557d. "It is probably necessary for the man who wishes to organize a city, as we were just doing, to go to a city under a democracy." That line is surely worth rereading. Because what Socrates, in effect, is saying is that if we want to do what we are right now doing, then maybe we have to be in a democracy. Well, what are we right now doing? "We" here refers to Socrates and Glaucon and Adeimantus, but also us, the readers. What we are right now doing is engaging in philosophy. So Socrates at 557d comes very close to saying, perhaps it's only in a democracy that we can practice philosophy. We've had some clues about this possibility in earlier stages of the Republic, and let me remind you what they are. First of all, when I was describing the democratic individual, who I said was whimsical, I mentioned that Socrates says that this person sometimes exercises, sometimes drinks a lot, sometimes engages in philosophy. Now, that engagement with philosophy is very short-lived and not very substantial, but it is nonetheless a mention that the democratic person might engage in philosophy. Another example. I've mentioned that a basic feature of democracy is the protection of privacy. And what this means is there is no obligation, no compulsion to be political. This is quite different. In fact, it's the opposite of what we find in the parable of the cave, where the philosopher has to be returned to the cave, has to be forced back into the cave, in other words, forced to be political. This is mimicked in the very beginning of the Republic. You recall Socrates is on his way home and he's forced, playfully, to stay in the Piraeus. The notion here would be, in a democracy where privacy is guaranteed, a person could pursue philosophy precisely because they don't have to be political. Another point. Again, this is a point I don't think most readers or scholars pay quite enough attention to. I tried to suggest it in my early lectures. Where is the Republic set? It's set in the Piraeus. What was the Piraeus? It was the stronghold of democratic opposition to the tyranny of the 30 in the years 404 and 403. One of the main characters in Book One of the Republic was Polemarchus. What do we know about him historically? He was executed by the tyrants. He was a democracy fighter. All of these clues lead me to wonder whether, in fact, Socrates' criticism of democracy isn't quite as blunt and hard-edged as it's very often taken to be. I'll put this point in one other way as a means of summarizing. Perhaps freedom of speech and the protection of privacy are necessary conditions for the possibility of philosophy. Isn't this what we imagine philosophy to be? If you and I are engaged in a philosophical conversation, what we want above all else is to be able to follow that conversation wherever it may lead. We don't want to be hemmed in intellectually at all. We want to be given the chance to talk all night if we want to. If you measure the length of the Republic, it's a very long dialogue. It has 10 books. It's one conversation. These people were apparently talking all night. And where were they talking? In a private home, the home of Cephalus and Polemarchus. I think the setting, again, is meaningful. This conversation that we have been engaged in from the very beginning itself takes place under the conditions available in a democracy. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting to you that Socrates' criticisms of the democracy were not serious. I think he meant each and every one of them. Democracy is excessively egalitarian. There's too much freedom. There's chaos. It's very often a big mess, the notion of formlessness that I introduced. Nonetheless, perhaps what Plato is finally trying to teach us about democracy is a very old lesson that's been echoed for the centuries. As bad as it is, and it is bad, it's the best available. I've already suggested to you, and this was my interpretation, I warned you of this at the time, I urged you to take my interpretation with a grain of salt, I've suggested that the edifice of the just city, which, if you recall, culminates in the expulsion of every citizen over the age of 10, that comes from the end of Book 7, is meant to be a demonstration that excessive authoritarian justice is actually not desirable. I use the phrase a reductio ad absurdum. I'm not sure at all that Plato is serious about constructing a just city and thinking it to be really the best city that we should all actually aspire to. In other words, I reject what you might call the blueprint theory of Plato's Republic. The blueprint theory is the notion that what we find in books 2 through 7 is a blueprint for an actual regime which we should aspire to. That is what I'm challenging. That's exactly parallel to what I'm suggesting here about Socrates' criticism of democracy. On the one hand, he means it. On the other hand, it's possible that there are certain hidden virtues in a democracy which he, in fact, is willing to affirm. The primary virtue would be the possibility of philosophy itself. After all, Socrates, the historical figure, lived from 469 to 399. Plato lived from 427 to 354. They lived in Athens. Athens was a democracy. So they flourished. Now, of course, they didn't simply flourish because Socrates was executed in 399. And Plato was undoubtedly overwhelmed by this experience in 399. I think if we put these two ideas together, we come up with this notion that finally Plato is ambivalent about democracy. It has terrible faults, one of them being the fact that the Athenian democracy executed Socrates, but it also allowed for Socrates in the first place. Let me conclude this lecture with what turns out to be the culminating criticism of democracy. And that is, according to Socrates, that a democracy leads to tyranny. And here's why. The democracy is, he says at 502d, drunk with the concept of freedom. As a result of this, the rulers must do what? We've already discussed this. The citizens are so hostile to any form of authority that rulers must flatter the citizens. They must please the citizens in much the same way that a teacher must entertain the students. So the ruler must entertain, please, satisfy the desires of the citizens. As a result of this dynamic, what emerges from a democracy, says Socrates, is the demagogue. The word demagogue comes from the Greek word demos, same as democracy, and the last part of that word means leader. The demagogue is the leader of the people. He is the supreme flatterer. He is the ultimate populist. He captivates the imagination of the majority of the citizens and becomes first among equals. Eventually, this person becomes a tyrant. And as we will find in the next lecture, there is no regime worse than the tyranny.
Lecture 19, Books 8 and 9, The Critique of Tyranny.
At the end of the last lecture, we were witnessing the emergence of the demagogue. The demagogue is the leader of the demos, of the people. He is the populist, the seducer of the masses. He flatters them. He gives them what they want, or perhaps more accurately, he gives them what they think they want. And as a result, they rally to his side. What we will find in this lecture is the evolution of the demagogue into the tyrant. This is one of those instances in books 8 and 9 of the Republic where we find Plato being very politically astute, because the pattern he will describe is one that has been reenacted more than once in the 20th century. If we think of the great tyrants of the 20th century, many of them began precisely as Socrates says the tyrant begins, as a populist, as a benefactor to the people. Think of Hitler emerging in Germany in the 30s. When the people were impoverished, when the people were desperate for new direction, they rallied to his side. Think of Mussolini, who famously got the trains running on time. In other words, improved the lives of ordinary citizens. Think of Stalin, who emerged from the Russian Revolution, a revolution that claimed to be championing the poor, the disenfranchised. These revolutionaries were taken to be benefactors of the people. And in this sense, they were all demagogues. The possibility of this sort of demagoguery was far greater in Athens than it would be and has been in our own democratic system. And this is because democracy in Athens was, by and large, a direct democracy. In the assembly, the citizens of Athens gathered and they would vote on just about anything. No issue would be decided outside of the assembly. Our own system, and much of it, in fact, I think, was inspired by a fear of the emergence of a demagogue. Our own system is not a direct democracy. Of course, we have a representative democracy, and we have several important non-democratic features built in to our own democratic system, not least of which is the Electoral College. A president isn't elected by the people, not technically. A president is elected by the Electoral College. The Supreme Court, each of the justices serves a term that lasts for his whole life. They're not subject to the whims of the people. These are just a couple of obvious features that are designed to lessen the impact of democracy in the workings of government. The Athenians didn't have this, and once again, this made them more subject to the kind of demagogic explosion that Socrates describes. Let's look at the genesis of the tyrant. Of course, he poses initially as the champion of the people, especially the poor. And you might look at lines 565a to c, where Socrates' description of this. The next move he makes is a crucial one. He demands his own bodyguards, his own even private militia or army. He has an excuse. He says to the people, I'm the champion of the poor. The rich hate me. The rich hate you. I need protection from the rich. The next move he makes is a logical extension of that move. And here I'm referring to 566c. He gets a taste of blood. He does this by executing one of his enemies. And he can easily explain this to his supporters. He'll say to them, he was a supporter of the rich. He was a representative of exactly that system that oppressed you so greatly. I'm your champion. Excuse me for killing this person. It was in your interest for me to do this. Socrates uses a metaphor here. He says the tyrant is a cannibal who tastes blood and then wants more. In other words, as the cliche famously has it, power corrupts. Once the demagogue has committed these acts of violence against his enemies, he feels a great sense of impunity. He has the people behind him, and he becomes a full-blown tyrant. He's at the initial stages of his rule. He is continuing his work on behalf of the poor. Socrates says at 566e that he releases the poor from their debts, and he actually distributes land to people who were otherwise landless. The next move the tyrant makes is to start a war with an enemy, a foreign enemy. Socrates mentions this also at 566e. And the reasoning here, I think, is quite predictable. When a country is attacked by a foreign enemy, the people rally around the flag. The people are in need of leadership. And this is exactly what the tyrant wants. So the tyrant, and this is a hateful thing he is doing, is eager to start war because war helps to solidify his own rule. He continues the process of executing his enemies, and he, in fact, extends this process to executing his former allies. And the reason he does this is, again, I think, rather predictable. The tyrant is becoming obsessed with power and the maintenance of his own power. Those people who were formerly his allies are people who are potentially strong once again. No doubt the tyrant had friends who were like him. And what do we know about the tyrant? He is aggressive. He is power hungry. He is passionate for political power. He is ruthless. He is dangerous. And so, therefore, he reasons, must be these so-called friends of mine, these so-called allies. He begins the systematic process of wiping out anybody who could be a threat to him, including, perhaps especially, his former allies. As a result of this, the tyrant is friendless. And not only is he friendless, he can't trust anybody after all, anybody represents a potential threat. The tyrant has systematically emptied the city of all those people in it who could possibly be capable, who could be, for example, excellent military people. What the tyrant really wants is to be surrounded by flatterers, by sycophants, people who only praise him and agree with him and flatter him. And this is an impoverishment of the city. Anybody worth his salt has been executed. The tyrant begins to spend lavishly, not only to protect himself, but also to magnify his own power in the city. He might, for example, build lots of palaces. The money that should be used for the maintenance of the city is starting to flow into the tyrant's pockets. And as a result of this, the rest of the city is becoming impoverished. Finally, to demonstrate the utter depravity of the tyrant, at 569b, Socrates says, "The tyrant is willing to kill his own father to stay in power." One way of summarizing this whole critique of tyranny, and you can see it, of course, is exactly that, highly, highly critical, is to say that the tyrant is a slave to his passions. He has a passionate desire for power. He is a slave to that passion because it's obliterated any sense of decency, any sense of other human beings' needs or desires. He has lost sight of the well-being of the community and only can see himself. The tyrant is a narcissist. You perhaps remember the famous myth of Narcissus. He was so impressed with his own beauty that he stared at his reflection in a pool of water and was unable to tear himself away from a vision of himself and therefore perished. This is the character sketch that Socrates is offering us of the tyrant. The tyrant is willing to act on all those savage impulses, and that's a quote from 572b, that most human beings actually have at one time or another. For example, in our dreams, we frequently dream about doing very terrible things, but the vast majority of the human race, thankfully, is able to control themselves, and we don't act on these impulses. The tyrant is a slave to those impulses. He has no way of moderating himself, correcting his behavior. He is, to summarize, friendless. He is always at risk of assassination. He is, says Socrates, unable to travel freely. He's living in an impoverished regime that's been denuded of its very best citizens. I suggest we now take a step away from the Republic and look at some contemporary events in order to see how penetrating and accurate Socrates' dissection and analysis of the tyrant really is. And what I would suggest we do for a few minutes is look at the most infamous tyrant of our own time, Saddam Hussein of Iraq. When you read The Republic, you sometimes think that Socrates is offering an analysis of someone just like Saddam Hussein. It's that accurate. Let me just remind you of a few facts about his awful career. He joined the Ba'ath Socialist Party in 1956. It's very telling that that was a socialist party. Its claim to fame was that it was a party that was going to champion the people, distribute the wealth, precisely as Socrates says. The Ba'ath began as the champion of the poor. By 1979, Saddam Hussein was the president of Iraq. And what was the very first thing he did? He initiated an 8-year war with neighboring Iran. This war lasted from 1979 to 1988. Again, this conforms precisely to Socrates' diagnosis of the tyrant. The tyrant needs war with external enemies. Saddam Hussein could say to his people, "These Iranians are attacking us. They hate us. They'll destroy us. Let's rally around the flag. Support me." The war was in his interest. It was his mechanism for consolidation of power. This is, to say the least, and as I said before, a disgusting feature of a tyrant. It's been said that, and I'm quoting now from the BBC News, that Saddam is a dictator who is ready to sacrifice his country just so long as he can remain on his throne in Baghdad. I quote that because it captures exactly the spirit, the personality, the narcissism of the tyrant as described by Socrates and as actually appearing in our own time in the person of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein killed his own people. He brutalized his own population. He used chemical weapons against the Kurds, his own fellow citizens. He executed many of his own generals. This is one reason his own army was so inadequate. There were no excellent generals to run it. There were no excellent generals because, like every tyrant, Saddam Hussein was threatened by anyone who had any kind of military talent or ambition. They represent a threat. The only people he could tolerate were those who would flatter him. Again, exactly as Socrates depicts the tyrant. Saddam Hussein never traveled freely. In fact, he moved from one of his palaces to the next. He never slept in the same place two nights in a row. He was that fearful of assassination. You recall the Socratic description of the tyrant. Despite the fact that the tyrant sits on the throne and seems to wield such enormous power, the tyrant is actually a slave. This is precisely what happened to Saddam Hussein. He was unable, to use the most simple example, to travel freely, to move on his own streets, because he had so completely alienated his own population. He had someone actually taste his own food before he ate it. He was that fearful of being poisoned. He led his country, the country of Iraq, into disaster. Iraq had great wealth from the production of oil. By the time Saddam Hussein was finished, it was impoverished and broken. Socrates says, and I'm quoting from 576e, "There is no city more wretched than one under tyranny." Let me next turn to another very surprising feature of Plato's Republic. In the previous lecture, I suggested that Socrates' attitude towards democracy was surprisingly ambivalent. On the one hand, a great critic, but on the other hand, not quite as hostile as many people believe he is. Something similar will happen in his treatment of tyranny. What we're going to discover is that there is a surprising and actually rather disturbing similarity between the philosopher and the tyrant. There is a little textual point I would make in order to suggest to you that Plato is going to try to communicate something very important in his passage on the tyrant. It's a very long passage. It runs from pages 564 to 580. That's a total of 16 pages. And what we discover, if you do just a little bit of calculation, is that the length of the passage that treats tyranny, the worst of the regimes, is almost exactly equal to the sum of those pages that had treated each of the previous three regimes. the timocracy, the oligarchy, and the democracy. That long passage, which treated those three regimes, ran from 547 to 563, also 16 pages. Plato is a very careful writer. I don't believe this is an accident. I believe it's a signal to the careful reader that something is going on in this treatment of tyranny that goes beyond its obvious import. Obviously, and very seriously, Socrates is criticizing tyranny. It's a terrible regime, make no mistake about it. Nonetheless, underneath the surface of this treatment of tyranny is something else. And what is it? I think the clue comes in line 573b. What we discover is that the tyrant, like the philosopher, is a highly erotic man, a man of great eros, that word whose basic meaning is sexual desire, but a word whose meaning Plato is continually expanding. Perhaps it's better to translate it simply as love. The tyrant has a passionate love of political power. The philosopher has a passionate love of wisdom. This is a very real similarity between the two. Refer you again to 573b. You'll read the lines that love, or eros, has from old been called a tyrant. Eros itself is a tyrant. Well, if the philosopher is erotic, then in some sense, the philosopher has an affinity with the tyrant. And it's that affinity which I want to explore in the remainder of this lecture. Let me take us all the way back to the very beginning, the all-important first scene in Book One of the Republic. The theme of Eros, as I've mentioned several times, is introduced there. The old man, Cephalus, is a peaceful, calm, content old man, and he says, "I'm very grateful that I'm no longer tyrannized by Eros." In very blunt terms, this means he's rather relieved that he's no longer driven crazy by sexual desires. But I think Plato draws the scene this way to get the reader thinking about this theme of Eros from the very beginning. There's a strong contrast, if you recall, between old, tired Cephalus and young, energetic Polemarchus. Polemarchus has the requisite energy to pursue the questions that Socrates is asking him. And it's exactly that energy that's required in order to participate in the philosophical enterprise. The philosophical enterprise requires desire. One must want to know the answer to Socrates' questions. His questions are so hard that only someone propelled by a very strong desire will even bother to try to answer them. Polemarchus is one such person. Glaucon is another. What we're finding in that first scene, then, is this potentially uncomfortable connection between the philosopher and the tyrant. Let me put the point this way. A potential philosopher is like a potential tyrant. And here I think we are well served by coming back to the character of Glaucon. Recall the beginning of Book Two. Thrasymachus, who had praised the life of injustice, who in fact had praised the life that a tyrant would lead, has been defeated by Socrates. But what does Glaucon do at the beginning of Book Two? He says to Socrates, "Look, you beat him in the argument. Everybody thinks you won, but I'm not satisfied. I'm not satisfied because I am not yet completely convinced that Thrasymachus was wrong. I'm not convinced that the life of justice is intrinsically better than the life of injustice. And that's what you need to prove to me." So you remember perhaps how Glaucon formulates this challenge. he tells a story, the story of the Ring of Gyges. Gyges was the shepherd. One day he got hold of this magical ring. If he used this ring properly, he became invisible. And so what did he do when he learned how to manipulate the ring and become invisible whenever he wanted to? He committed crimes. He committed adultery with the queen. He killed the king. He became what? He became a tyrant. Glaucon suggests that this is, in fact, what most of us would really do if we had the Ring of Gyges. We would commit unjust acts. What Glaucon is demanding from Socrates is a philosophical explanation that would explain why we shouldn't commit unjust acts if we could get away with them. Let me put my point slightly differently. Glaucon clearly has a very great imagination. He's imagining this character of Gyges and what he would do if he had the ring that made him invisible. This is a great tribute to Glaucon. It shows, again, he's energetic, he's intellectual, he's challenging, he's demanding, he wants a lot from Socrates. But it also pinpoints exactly what is potentially dangerous about Glaucon. Such a person may not restrain himself sufficiently. Such a person, in short, is a potential tyrant. This is not, for Plato, writing in the 4th century, an abstract concern. I take you back to the 5th century. Plato witnessed people like Glaucon. The characters I've mentioned before, these are historical figures, were Alcibiades. Alcibiades was a historical figure. He was an associate of Socrates. Socrates saw him as a potential philosopher, but in fact, Alcibiades, deep down, really wanted political power. I mentioned the dialogue, The Charmides, written by Plato, featuring Socrates talking to a young man, Charmides, and an older man, Critias. Charmides in particular, another young man with great promise, smart, energetic, ambitious, aggressive, in some erotic. He wants a lot from life itself. In historical fact, Charmides became a tyrant. He was one of the tyranny of the 30. This is a genuine fear on Plato's part. I think this is why he crafts the Republic as mainly a discussion between Socrates and Glaucon. Socrates is trying to convert Glaucon, to turn his impulses away from the political to the philosophical. I'm saying all of this by way of trying to explain what I described as this surprising and uncomfortable affinity that obtains between philosophy and tyranny. Both the tyrant and the philosopher have a disregard for convention, for traditional morality. We certainly saw that in Socrates, when he opens the Republic by asking Cephalus, what's it like to be so old and be about to die? I describe that as a very rude and aggressive question. And I believe it is. It's an innocuous question in terms of a philosophical explanation, but Plato's genius is to locate serious issues in these small, seemingly innocuous exchanges. You've read The Republic, perhaps you've read other dialogues by Plato. One response students regularly have to Socrates is, he's a bully. He's always making people answer his questions. He's always dictating the rules of the conversation. That's not a misleading impression. He is a kind of bully. That's another way of saying he is not entirely dissimilar to a tyrant. Let me refer you to line 578c. This is still Socrates' discussion of the tyrant. In fact, what he does in this passage is say there really are two kinds of tyrants. There are what we might call private tyrants, and then there are public tyrants. A public or political tyrant is the person who actually lives out the tyrannical desires in the political sphere. Now, Socrates doesn't tell us who the private tyrant would be. It's one of these mysteries in the Republic. It's one of these occasions where I'm quite confident Plato is asking the reader to think for himself or for herself. Who would be the private tyrant? Maybe it's the person who is tyrannized by the love of wisdom. I mean, I would ask you just to reflect a little bit on what it means to really fall in love. We all know what it's like to fall in love with a person, but we also fall in love with other things. You might fall in love with opera, or you might fall in love with painting, or you might fall in love, as I have, with the Boston Red Sox. These are desires that are potentially tyrannical. They will dominate your life. You'll try to get them out of your head, and you can't do it. Perhaps the philosopher is such a person, tyrannized by the love of wisdom and unwilling to pursue any other object except wisdom itself. And I would suggest that's not a bad description of our friend Socrates.
Lecture 20, Book 9, The Superiority of Justice.
We've reached Book 9 of Plato's Republic. We're getting close to the finish line. Socrates has finished the entire exercise that he promised to complete. He has constructed what he claims is a perfectly just city, and he has also analyzed the various forms of injustice. He is now prepared in a final way to address the original question posed to him by Glaucon. Why prefer a life of justice to a life of injustice? Why not, if we could get away with it, lead a life in which we committed unjust acts and simply attempted to maximize our own self-interest, even if it meant trampling over the interests of others? In short, Socrates is finally prepared to answer once and for all the challenge posed by Thrasymachus in Book 1. We've seen the real answer to the question already. It was contained in the analysis of the tyrant. The tyrant is the maximally unjust human being. And the tyrant, you recall, was described as being a slave. He seems to be on top of the world. He seems to be the political leader of his own country. In fact, he's no more than a slave. He is a slave to his passions. Socrates elaborates this argument in several ways in Book 9, and that's what we'll discuss in this lecture. To do this, he returns to a subject he broached in Lecture 4. This is often referred to as Plato's tripartite psychology. This is the psychological scheme in which the human psyche, often translated as soul, is said to have three parts: reason, spirit, and desire. Socrates returns to this tripartite scheme in Book 9, but in a very interesting way, he subtly but significantly reformulates the three parts. Instead of being reason, spirit, and desire, we find at 581c these three parts. There is the wisdom-loving, the victory-loving, and the gain-loving. clearly corresponding to reason, spirit, and desire, but significantly reformulated because now each of the parts is said to be in love with an object, whether the object is wisdom, victory, or gain. This, I hope, substantiates one of the claims I've made a few times in our course, and that is that for Plato, the very essence of the human psyche, the human soul, is eros, is love. Because now we see that even these seemingly distinct parts of the soul are unified by the fact that each one of them is described as a form of love. In this sense, the soul is really nothing but love. What differentiates one soul from another is what it loves. The oligarch, for example, loves gain. The timocrat loves honor, and the philosopher loves wisdom. Socrates then turns to a new issue. It's not really new. It's a new perspective on the old question, why prefer justice over injustice? And he argues that, in fact, the just person has a life that's vastly more pleasurable than anyone else. If you recall a comment I made much earlier in our course, I was describing the position of hedonism. Hedonism is that position which equates pleasure and the good. For the hedonist, if something is pleasurable, it's good, period, end of story. Socrates rejects hedonism, and he rejects it by means of the following argument. He insists that there are good pleasures and bad pleasures. And once that distinction is made, as we've discussed, there is a standard higher than pleasure that's invoked in order to measure pleasures. So pleasure is not the good. Good pleasure is good. What Socrates is arguing in this section of the Republic is that justice, in fact, philosophy, because we know that the just ruler is the philosopher, gives us the highest, the best form of pleasure. So what I would like to do next is review three of the arguments that Socrates gives on behalf of this thesis. I warn you in advance that you may not be entirely satisfied by these arguments. If that's the case, I would urge you to be patient with Plato because, in fact, I suspect that these arguments are not satisfying and that Plato understands that they're not satisfying. He has something else in mind, as he usually does. He has a little trick up his sleeve. The first argument, the argument on behalf of the idea that philosophy actually gives us the best form of pleasure. The argument here is that the philosopher is the best judge of pleasure. The philosopher is the best critic. Now, why is that? Because the philosopher has tasted every kind of pleasure. The philosopher knows what it is to feel pleasure from gain. The philosopher knows what it is to feel pleasure from honor. The competitors, however, have not tasted the pleasure of wisdom. And therefore, they are in an inferior position to make a judgment about what is the best pleasure. It follows, again, that if the philosopher is the best judge, then the pleasure that the philosopher chooses must be the best pleasure. And of course, we know what pleasure that would be. It's the pleasure of philosophy. Socrates believes he's won his point. I would urge you on your own to review the steps of this argument and you try to figure out for yourself if you think it holds water. As I suggested, it may very well not. Second argument. The pleasure that arises from the love of wisdom, unlike other pleasures, does not give rise to its opposite, pain. It is a pure pleasure. The argument for this position is given at 584b. what does Socrates have in mind? Well, the easiest contrast to make is the hangover. We have a wonderful night of eating and drinking and drinking and drinking. A lot of pleasure, yes, but we pay a big price the next day. Socrates suggests that, in fact, all physical pleasures are like this, even if they're not as overtly connected to pain as the hangover, they are nonetheless caught up in this same transitioning from pleasure to pain, from pain to pleasure. Philosophy, by contrast, he argues, is a pure pleasure. There is no pain that follows the pleasures that we gain from the study of philosophy. Again, perhaps not the most satisfying argument, but certainly interesting. The third argument is very much related to the second. And this I'm referring to is found at 584C. The object of philosophy, the goal of philosophical inquiry, is being. That's a term we've used several times, especially in conjunction with the famous Platonic forms and the idea of the good. The salient feature of being is that it's permanent, it's stable, changeless, eternal, perfect in every way. The key word here is stable. If the philosopher aims to articulate and understand being itself, if the philosopher aims, for example, to move up the divided line, start at the bottom in the realm of images, move all the way up to the top, the idea of the good, such a person, says Socrates here in Book 9, is going to engage a kind of pleasure that's very stable. The pleasure one feels from studying being, Socrates says, is as stable as the object itself, namely being. Now, this may not be very clear, so let me illustrate it again by means of a contrast. Let's go back to our old friend, the oligarch. The oligarch loves profit, gain, money. What do we know about people who love money? And I'll speak anachronistically here. Someone who loves money might invest very heavily in the stock market. And the stock market goes way up, and such a person is very happy, feels a lot of pleasure. But anybody who has invested in the market will know that what goes up must come down. So the person who's made a killing in the stock market and feels pleasure doesn't find that pleasure lasting very long. Either the stock market will crash, and then this person will feel a lot of pain, or even if it doesn't crash, this person will feel what? Anxiety, stress. If you have money, you worry about money. Money, in this case, is an example of a very unstable object. The stock market is the best example of that. Being, by contrast, doesn't go up and down. There are no fluctuations in being. Being is not subject to market forces. Therefore, the pleasure gained by the study of being is a very enduring, stable pleasure. Another way to put this is, no one can take being away. If I'm a student of being, I don't have to fear that somebody's going to steal it from me. If I have a lot of money, I might very well worry that somebody will steal it from me. If I'm engaged in pleasures of the body, I might very well worry that when I get old, I won't be able to experience these pleasures. If I'm a lover of the body, I will probably, above all else, fear death, because death would mean the termination of my pleasures. Again, by contrast, the lover of philosophy, the lover of being, has no such anxiety to plague him. The more you read Plato's dialogues, not just the Republic, the more you'll feel this sense of pleasure in the character. Socrates never seems to get upset. He's famous for only laughing three times. We never see him cry. He doesn't seem to experience any of the stress, anxiety that we, and of course, ancient Athenians, were so familiar with. He seems to lead a life of constant, stable pleasure. Again, when I speak of Socrates, I refer only to the character appearing in Plato's dialogues. Did the real Socrates live this way? Who knows? We can't know. But as a character created by Plato, inspired by a historical figure, but no doubt filled with Plato's imagination, the character clearly is meant to express just this idea, that a lover of wisdom doesn't suffer the ups and downs, the hangovers, the stresses that the lover of gain or the lover of honor will regularly experience. One last word about the lover of honor. It's a very important point. We might think of a lover of honor also as a lover of fame, loves recognition. Well, such a person might get great pleasure from fame and recognition, but the public is very fickle. And so therefore, such a person will once again be in a state of stress. And therefore, the pleasure gained by fame is fleeting and unstable. The contrast with philosophy can be made again. These arguments about pleasure are designed to remind us of the essential task Socrates believes he has now completed, to demonstrate to Glaucon that the life of philosophy is in every which way superior to any other life. In particular, it's most superior to the life of the tyrant, the person who is able, apparently, to maximize his own self-interest. At this point, and the point I'm referring to in the text is found at 587e, Socrates makes a joke, not a joke that will cause you to laugh out loud, but a subtle philosophical joke. Socrates says the philosopher king, the philosopher ruler, the philosopher queen, the thoroughly just philosophical soul that we've explored for all these many pages, lives 729 times more pleasantly than the tyrant. So the best life is precisely 729 times better than the worst life. This is a joke because who could possibly demonstrate with such mathematical precision that one life is 729 times better, more pleasant than another life? The joke seems to be based, as Socrates later mentions, on the notion that in a year, a calendar year, there are 729 days and nights total. So it seems to be an indication of the complete superiority of the philosophical life. Let me suggest something else about this joke. It opens up a theme we've explored more than once in this course, and that's the relationship between mathematics and the human soul. It is manifestly absurd to think you could calculate the superiority of a life and come up with a number as precise as 729. But what's the point of the joke? The point of the joke is similar to a point I made about the marriage number in Book 8 of the Republic. If you recall that passage, it's near the beginning of Book 8. The perfectly just city must regulate sexual reproduction. It must develop what today we would call the science of genetic engineering, or eugenics. The marriage number is a very obscure passage. We can't fathom the mathematics there, but the point is clear. The rulers fail to calculate the marriage number. In other words, they fail to arrive at a mathematically based science which would be able to control eros. the beginning of this lecture, I suggested that eros is shorthand for the human